You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 53 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. This episode is being sponsored by the Belly Dance Bundle, a heavily discounted bundle of amazing belly dance products from dancers around the world. They're all online and all at your own pace, and I'm one of the contributors, and so are several of our Clubhouse guests. That's coming in just a few weeks, so if you'd like to sign up for updates, you can do that at bellydancegeek.com/bundle. The Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, things like moves, combinations, choreographies, it's really easy to find resources. But if you're interested in the why and the how, things like culture, musicality, composition, business, ethics, all of that is harder to get. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Farha, which means joy in Arabic. And she performs and teaches in the New York City area in order to share the joy of this dance with anyone who needs a little more sparkle in their lives. And don't we all? Farha started learning to dance in Western New York and has spent the past 11 plus years sorting and prioritizing what she's learned and is learning into a cohesive curriculum. She especially loves guiding dancers from the beginner level to the intermediate and digging into the tangled history of our dance. You can check her out at farhabellydance.com, spelled F-A-R-H-A, bellydance.com. So welcome, Farha.
Hello.
So today, Farha is going to talk about how to map your own dance journey. But before we jump into that, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in belly dance?
Yeah, I had it kind of pop into and out of my life a few times. Like a friend of our family gave me a fitness tape, VHS tape, back when I was in middle school. I really liked it, but I kind of thought that it was something I'd never physically be able to do. Like, I thought it was like some kind of contortionism that you had to learn when you were young and bendy. So it kind of disappeared again. And then in high school, a friend got the Dancing the Sacred Shapes with the Goddess Dancing DVD. And also that was when I found Shira.net. But it kind of faded away again until I was in undergrad and another friend got the same DVD. And that's kind of when I start counting like how long I've been dancing for. That was about when Shimmy was on Fit TV. I got some other DVDs like Jenna's Basics and Beyond. All of those DVDs just kind of broke down the basic vocab and like ended there, the movement vocabulary. I was still in undergrad. I took some fusion classes over the summer before starting my senior year. I could only take a couple because I was working retail. And I danced at like an open mic night at my undergrad. And I should not have been performing, but I did not know that. And luckily I did because the secretary at my undergraduate department saw about it and it invited me to come take classes where she was taking them. And I didn't think that there would be any classes out there. So I drove halfway to Buffalo to take classes in a little teeny tiny town called Silver Creek. And it was at a Curves gym, and I think I was the youngest person there by about 20 years. And it was definitely kind of a fitness-oriented class. So I had, before that, been kind of trying to, like, organize dance workshops at school, where I was kind of, like, rattling off, like laundry list style, what I'd learned on my DVDs. And it wasn't because I thought I was like really good. I was just so excited about belly dance. And I thought that if people know how amazing belly dance is, then they would all be doing it too. And since they don't all do it already, then they must not know about it. And I really wanted people to dance with. So after I started taking the classes in Silver Creek, I was like, well, why should I teach when somebody with so much more experience and info is actually close enough to be able to do that? So I stopped trying to make workshops happen. When I moved back to Syracuse after graduating, I took a tribal class, and because the class in Silver Creek had made me realize that I liked the other style too, because back then I didn't know that there were more than two styles of belly dance. I also started taking class with the woman who was kind of my long-term teacher, Hannah, and that's when I learned zilling and veil and balancing and floor work and all of that stuff.
So. Cool. And before I move on with the interview, I know where all of those places you mentioned are because I grew up in Buffalo.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And I've got to send a shout out to the Goddess Dancing who are here in Boston. So,
yes.
Yeah.
It's
so like,
funny because that even is what got me into it. And when I finally got, when I got back to Syracuse after graduating and I started taking classes with Hannah, who is now part of the Three Early Girls group there that sponsors events twice a year, she actually had danced with the Goddess Dancing when she lived in Boston. So it was very serendipitous.
Small world.
Yes.
Awesome. So, you know, today we're going to be talking about mapping your dance journey. So what got you interested in thinking about how to do that?
So like I said, I took class with Hannah, and I was really lucky that I got her as my teacher, because she taught by kind of giving us techniques and then having us apply them to our own dancing and our own style. And because of the way that I interpreted the movement breakdowns on those DVDs in a really internal and muscular way, and because of the YouTube clips that I gravitated towards and the music that I ended up listening to, my style ended up kind of coming out a little bit Egyptian. I'm sure I had a very strong American accent, but from her perspective, coming from the very vintage AMCAB, I remember one time in class, she looked at me and was like, "You're doing that Egyptian style. Where are you getting this from?" And after around like 4 or so years, something like that, during the which time she was the one who told me to start performing and to start teaching, she eventually said that she didn't have anything else to teach us. And I think that she was underestimating what she knew and how much we had retained. But I think a lot of it was that the kind of the belly dance superstars and Shakira crazes had died out. So there weren't enough intermediate students for her to keep a group class going. So at that time in Syracuse, there were a bunch of tribal studios and not really anybody doing Egyptian style, much less old school Egyptian style. So I kind of started focusing on taking workshops and on teaching because, you know, she had suggested I teach and I love teaching. So now I'm in New York City, I take regular classes again, but when I first started out, I was kind of on my own. And then for the bulk of like the middle of my dancing, I've been kind of having to pick like, okay, what's going to help me, you know, get where I want to go. And because when I first started, I kind of mentioned, like, I had performed before I was ready, and then I was like, oh, no, I shouldn't be doing this, and stopped. And so I think there's a lot of things that we tend to, there's a lot of places where you can kind of start doing something and think that you're good, and not realize that you might be making a mistake. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's jump right in then. You know, what does mapping your own journey actually mean? You know, it sounds great on the surface, but what are kind of the, what does it look like? What kind of activities does that include?
You're basically making a syllabus for your dance education, basically. I there's kind of three ways to learn, and I'm going to compare it to learning. I'm going to compare learning belly dance to exploring a new city. So option one is that you just let your teacher guide you, and it's like getting on a tour bus, and like you'll see all the main places, and you'll get to you get the exact same experience as all the other tourists on the bus with you. Option two, you could get yourself like a Lonely Planet book and decide exactly what you want to see, what interests you, and how you want to spend your time. And that's mapping your own journey. Or you could just kind of wander around the city with no map and just kind of hope you find something cool and avoid the bad neighborhoods. If you think back to belly dance in the US in the 50s, wandering around with no map was like your only option. You just go around, ask locals what's good, and just kind of hope that that works out. And I've done that too. I was in Hawaii a while ago and just asked a bunch of shopkeepers where a good hike would be. And that was my favorite point of the journey. So there's something to be said for it. But especially these days when, you know, live clubs and live music is on the decline, it's a lot harder to get good information that way. Because the quality of information that you get from asking a house musician versus a new waiter at some random hookah bar is going to be very different. So these days, most students kind of expect the tour bus experience. You get on the class bus and you get led from one place to another. You have a little time to snap a selfie at your Hofla and you just trust your teacher. You don't need a map. The teacher knows like what highway to get on to take you to the next vineyard and where there's the best cheese and where to get the best view of the countryside. And the more casual you are as far as what you want to get out of dance, the better this approach is. But if you're reliant on your teacher to tell you what the next step is and when to take it, then it's harder to develop your own style and your own voice. And some teachers are really great at helping their students develop their own style and their own voice. And that's why I said I was so lucky to have Hannah as my teacher. But you know, you also want to kind of be able to take control of that in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so first you have to figure out where you want to end up, and that can change. You can adjust your path as you're traveling it. But you need to kind of get past the you don't know what you don't know paradox in order to do it, which is also really tricky.
Mm-hmm. I love that metaphor, especially because one of the summers when I was in college, I worked in Ireland for a summer. And yeah, it was awesome. I was there on a kind of a special technical visa. I worked with a robotics company. But this was the summer after my sophomore year, and I wasn't actually that helpful. Like, I ended up ordering a lot of parts. You know, it wasn't like any kind of high thing. But, you know, it was a spinoff from a university lab, and they were brand new. They didn't have a lot of money. And so they essentially paid me like a waitress. But I worked 4 days a week. So I had a long weekend every single weekend. Okay. And I had this really amazing experience exploring the country. And I did all three of the things that you talked about. I would wander around Dublin and just say, you know, if somebody looked like they know what they're doing, I'd say, hey, does this restaurant look any good? Right. Mm-hmm. I went on a whole bunch of bus tours because I don't drive. So, yeah. You know, if I needed to go places that were a little bit more remote, I would always take the bus tour because they would get me there. And I also had a Lonely Planet, although I have to say I was a bigger fan of the Let's Go series, okay. Right? But I had both, right? And then I would just, you know, every weekend I would go somewhere else. And I feel like all three of those things have value to offer.
Exactly.
And so I love that you're breaking it down that way.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did Italy and Greece out of a Lonely Planet book. But while I was in Italy, I also got on a bus and took a wine tour. I didn't have a car while I was there, so the only way I was going to be able to do that was with the wine tour. So I got bucket list item. I got to go wine tasting in Tuscany.
Nice. Yeah. Awesome. So when we talk about this process, you know, who can benefit from this? Is it just for people who don't have a teacher, or who else is this for?
I think it's good for everybody. Obviously, if you don't have a teacher, then it's going to be a lot more involved for you than for somebody who does. If you want to kind of develop your own style, and kind of do more than go along for the ride of your weekly classes, then it's helpful. If you do have regular classes, you still need some sort of goal setting and mapping to kind of just like supplement in order to avoid being a carbon copy of your teacher. And like, sometimes you can tell when somebody has only ever studied with one teacher and never really put any other kind of input into their creative well, because you'll see their teacher perform and it's like a fresh can of soda, and then they'll perform and you're like, oh, where did all the bubbles go? So there's a lot of different ways that you can kind of feed your creative well, but in order to develop your own style, you have to put those different kind of inputs in and let them kind of brew around inside of you and come back out through the filter of your own experience. And teachers are a great resource for helping you make sense of what all these inputs are, like putting them in context, helping you understand the musicality. Like when you have a new YouTube video that you just saw and, oh my God, this dancer is amazing. Your teacher can help you to kind of process that. But you still need to be putting in those kind of inputs. So it's helpful to know where you want to go. Mm-hmm.
Now, we talked about its role in developing your own style, but are there any other things that we get out of being more active about directing our own education?
Yeah, I mean, you get to, I think, I'm trying to phrase this delicately. So sometimes you might come across a teacher who's going to bamboozle you. I've been in a class where a very experienced teacher was saying, oh, this workshop here with me and this other person is the only place that you can get this kind of information. And I kind of exchanged a look with one of the other students in the workshop, because the both of us had like a month ago been at another workshop with a different teacher getting the same information from them. But if I'd been if I hadn't like invested any effort into researching things on my own, and if I was this person's student and had been a beginner with her and didn't have any other context to compare that to, I might have believed her and then thought that any time somebody else came up with similar information, they must not know what they're talking about because my teacher told me she's the only one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think another thing that's relevant is that what we struggle for, we retain better. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes Definitely. If you get fed some information, you might process it to a certain degree, but if you have to dig more deeply to get it for yourself, often you're much more likely to integrate it into your dance more deeply.
You are, and I think you're also more likely to, you're going to develop a deeper understanding of how it fits in with everything else. I very strongly believe that like the context of everything is important, and part of it is just because the way I learn is I don't learn things by memorizing them. If you put me back in third grade and tell me to memorize the times tables, then I'm not going to pass that times test. But if you tell me why something works or how something works, then I'll retain it. So I agree.
Now, in terms of, our dance educational path or our dance careers, what is the best time to start doing this? Is it possible to do it too early?
So I started doing this on my own, like right from the beginning, from the hip bones connected to the leg bone. I had zero previous dance training. So every time a workshop teacher says things like, well, we Westerners tend to do things this way, because we're used to ballet or ballroom and Arabs do it that way, I'm just totally lost when they do that. I once had a DVD that said, oh, it's just a pot of beret. I spent weeks trying to figure out what the blank was going on with this dancer's legs until I realized, oh, it's just the thing we do when we switch from hip drops on one side to hip drops on the other. So this is just kind of an aside soapbox. You absolutely can learn Middle Eastern dance in 100% Middle Eastern context. So soapbox over. I actually don't recommend doing what I did for most people. My dad's a chiropractor and I did martial arts before I started dancing. It's like I grew up playing with model spines and looking at anatomy posters every time I visited their office. So I was able to follow the movement breakdowns on these DVDs in a way that I wasn't really going to injure myself. But I still developed really bad upper body posture habits. So especially when you're starting, I recommend that having a teacher who can help you with kind of just keeping track of everything. Because when you're first starting out, it's a lot. You're keeping track of your feet and your knees and your pelvis and your lumbar spine and your ribcage and your shoulders and your arms and your face. And don't forget to breathe. And it makes it feel easy to pat your head and rub your belly at the same time. So it's a good idea when you're first starting to have a teacher just to help you with that. Once you have kind of a solid technique foundation so that you can do a hip circle without letting your, without hyperextending your lower back or, you know, things like that, then it's a little easier to be a little more independent. But I would say don't let that stop you. If you don't have access to a teacher and for some reason like Skype lessons are not an option, things like ergonomics and stuff, you can always like find a physical therapist or a chiropractor to give you feedback on. So if that's like going to stop you from dancing, then I would say don't let it stop you. But if you have the option to have a teacher, then at least in the beginning, at least until you have a good foundation that you're not going to injure yourself, go to a real class. And live classes are just in general better for a whole lot of reasons, but they should be part of this journey that you've mapped out.
Yeah.
Does that answer it?
Absolutely. Okay. I kind of want to piggyback on that a little bit too. I really strongly agree that especially for like the first couple months, and my usual rule of thumb is about 6 months, it really is important to trust your teacher. Yeah. So my very first teacher was awesome, but I was only in the city that she was in for the summer. Again, I essentially went to a different place every summer when I was in college. And so I only had 6 lessons with her before I had to go home. And then when I got back to Boston, you know, we actually had a pretty wide variety of teachers and I didn't really know where to start, but I had done all this research online. And I wouldn't say that I thought I knew everything, but I had kind of gotten this sense that the majority of teachers out there were charlatans who didn't really know what they were talking about, and only a few of them were doing the real thing, and a lot of them were going to cause you to hurt your back and ruin your posture and all this stuff. And so the teacher that I ended up studying with first, and I'm not going to name names because I'm embarrassed. I don't want her to know about it.
I can't find the teacher that was my first teacher in Silver Creek. I think her name was Jennifer. Mm-hmm. But I can't find her anywhere.
Yeah. So the teacher that I ended up with, for mostly logistical reasons, was somebody that I found myself constantly essentially comparing her to the first teacher and not understanding that there are differences in technique that are all valid. And so between the things I had read online and the things that I learned in my first few classes, I genuinely thought she was doing it wrong. And so I stayed in the class for, I don't remember how long, maybe 9 months. And all the time I was like, you're doing it wrong. Why am I in this class? And in hindsight, I know that she was doing it perfectly well. She was a perfectly competent teacher. It wasn't the right fit for me in terms of her goals for us. And so I'm glad that I moved on, but like, I never said anything to anybody. So it's not like I dissed her in public, but like, I feel really bad for having disrespected her in my own head when, you know, what she had was perfectly valid. And I think that if I had I think that if she had been my first teacher and I didn't have that background of, you know, everybody out there is a fraud, that I would have been much more open to what she had to teach and then eventually moved on because it wasn't the right path for me. But I think that I would have gotten more out of the class if I had come in that open place too.
Yeah. I forgot what I was going to say in response to that.
That's okay. If you think of it later, we can come back to it. So, you know, speaking of the teachers, you know, how does your relationship with your teacher affect this process?
For my teacher just flat out said, I don't have anything else to teach you guys, and quit giving group lessons to anyone past beginners. One of my classmates back then, she had an extremely possessive teacher who would give her shish for just taking class with anybody else. And then
red flag, you guys.
Yeah, major red flag. And that other teacher who gave my classmate ish for taking the class that we were in together, she had been a student of a different teacher that thank God, left the area by the time I was there, who would like not let experienced students into her classes because it would have made the her other students realize that she was not teaching them belly dance. She was teaching like a Indian dance therapy fusion and calling it belly dance. She used to like go around taking other people's flyers down and not let her students go to like other dance events and not let other students into her events. So, so yeah, aside from those like really, really possessive ones that I hope are in the minority, like teachers should be encouraging you to take classes with other teachers. I moved to New York City and I had to rehome my students, and it felt like I was breaking up kids into different foster families, but they all needed different things. Like I had a couple students who were a better fit for the teacher in the area that was going to be able to give them more performance opportunities. I had one who really just needed a community of women to develop with. And so she went to a different teacher, and another who didn't want to do either of those styles and wanted to be in a class where the teacher wasn't too intimidatingly young and pretty. So I will admit to having kind of felt bad when students went to other teachers, but I tried to never discourage them. And I just use it to reflect on what was I failing to deliver. It wasn't that I felt bad, like, oh, they're leaving me, they're so disloyal. It was nothing like that. It was just like, oh God, what am I doing wrong? What am I not giving them? So I just try and reflect on it and decide if it's an actual shortcoming of my teaching that I need to fix, or if it's just that the other teacher is a better fit and a better, like there has different philosophy or style or something that the student needs right now. At the end of the day, your teachers are giving you a service. So if that service isn't what you need, then there shouldn't be any hard feelings. And if your relationship is more than just a business relationship, if you're also friends, then if they're your friend, they should be supportive of what you need and getting what you need for your journey. I think it might be a good idea to, depending on the situation and like what your relationship is, and maybe if you're like one of three students and without you, she's going to have to cancel the class. But it can be a good idea to talk to them about what you feel is missing, and what you feel like you need, but she's not giving you. And they might have a good reason for not introducing it yet, or it might just be outside her wheelhouse, and she might have good ideas about what resources you can go to. Or she might be interested in you coming back and showing her what you learned in this other topic. So like an example of that first thing would be like, maybe you really, really want to learn ISIS wings. And she's like, agrees that it's a really cool thing to learn, but we're working in class on our upper body carriage right now, and I haven't taught ISIS wings yet because we all need to address the things that we're doing with our shoulders and our arms before you're ready for those.
And or we all so, like, can't asking, fit in the room with ISIS wings at the same time.
That's a good point too. I'm going to teach you guys, and I'm just waiting for the summer so we can do it in the park. if you have that kind of relationship, then have a conversation with them, and maybe they'll either tell you like, well, you know, that's a good thing to learn, but these are the things you want to think about first, or yeah, I can offer that next semester, or that's not really in my wheelhouse. Here's someone I know who you can go learn it from, or I don't know who to go learn that from. Let me know what you find out. So if it's like a major philosophy conflict, then I really don't know what to say. And I kind of just hope everybody can be grownups. But if it's different styles or different goals for the class, like you really want to start gigging, but she's only doing a fitness class, that's not any kind of judgment on the teacher, and nobody should take that personally.
Cool. Well, let's start thinking about some of the things that make this hard. You know, what are some of the challenges or barriers to getting a good belly dance education in general, much less when you're guiding your own path?
Yeah. If you don't have any, I think mostly it's that you don't know what you don't know. And it's kind of a paradox. Like, if you don't know that that song you want to dance to is an instrumental version of one that normally has words and is actually about someone's lover leaving them, then you don't know that it's not appropriate to dance to that at someone's wedding. So it's really hard. And if, for example, if you're me and you're in your first belly dance class in Silver Creek, and you hear the teacher say, if you're gonna pony step, you need to step on the beat, but you don't know what the rhythm or the beat is. I'm telling you this story because it's proof that if I can learn it, you can learn it. That I think that's the main challenge. And that just comes from kind of digging around and sorting out some puzzle pieces.
And specifically when you're guiding your own journey, what are some of the pitfalls that you can face and how do you get around them?
If you don't have a teacher at all, ever, then you can really just like end up anywhere. You know, you can end up doing some really bonkers things because you don't have any kind of context. So in that situation, you need to be really critical of your sources, which can get really tiring because it's nice to have someone like vetting the sources for you. If your teacher's more hands-off, that can be really great for developing your own style, but it can be harder if you want to break into performing professionally, because in that kind of situation, you're going to want more guidance. And I think that having kind of a teacher that's facilitating is the sweet spot, especially if you have access to somebody who has compatible like dance philosophies and goals. And I'm using the things that you sent me in the pre-show notes to sort these out. If you have an authoritarian teacher, somebody like one of those possessive teachers that I mentioned before, I think that's, I would rather have no teacher than somebody who is going to like put me in a black box and tell me that this is the only right way and you can only trust me, and have a Mother Gothel from Tangled kind of situation. Because in that kind of situation, they might be feeding you some kind of story, and you might get some really good, correct information and dismiss it because it doesn't fit in with the story that was fed to you. So yeah, when you have a really possessive or authoritarian, my way is the only way teacher, that is a major red flag. But luckily we have the internet, so it's really hard for people to get away with that.
You know, one thing I want to add on to that too is that there are some really authoritarian teachers who actually really know their stuff, yeah, and are awesome dancers and give you really great information, but they can still hold you back as a dancer just because so much of like the traditional values of this dance are around expressing yourself. Mm-hmm. And so if you never have the opening to explore what you like and express what you like and what you hear, and you get into that carbon copy space, in a way, yeah, you're being less authentic.
Yeah. You don't want to be you don't want to be flat soda.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And, you know, one thing I want to mention that you and I have talked about, I think partly because we were talking a little bit about what we wanted to cover in advance, mm-hmm, that I want to call out to everybody else is that if you're in a place that doesn't have weekly belly dance classes available to you, that's not the same thing as not having a teacher, right? If you have somebody you work with over Skype or a mentor that you work, mm-hmm, with occasionally, I don't have permission to name names, so I'm not going to call anybody out by name, but if you're listening and you know who you are, let me give you a wave. But I worked with someone who is in a really, really remote area, but she traveled a couple times a year. She took Skype lessons. Mm-hmm. You know, she got a lot of personal feedback and it really showed in her dancing, right? She was just a really good dancer, even though she didn't have the luxury of going to weekly classes or more than one class a week. like I did.
Yeah. I kept learning. I kept seeking out teachers. Even after my regular teacher stopped having classes, I went to a lot of workshops. Mm-hmm. And that was before I knew how to use Skype. So
for me, that was before Skype existed.
I think it existed when I was in undergrad, but I just couldn't figure it out. It was like something, nobody did Skype lessons. It was something that you video chatted with like your parents when you were doing study abroad.
Well, the internet wasn't fast enough at that point.
That's true. That's very, very true.
Let me put on my old hat right now.
My first belly dance instructional was a VHS tape.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, we talked a little bit about misinformation and stuff. So what are some of the challenges in finding accurate information or even useful information?
So we'll say, like, in addition to, like, kind of what's up with what kind of teacher you have, if you're, if you're learning on your own, another thing to really look out for is whether you have, it's because you don't have the same kind of accountability, is to work on, like, how are you going to make your practice regular? So I'm going to plug your product with the sustainable Woo-hoo! Practice course. I wanted to make sure I mentioned that, or that getting good practice, and make sure also that you don't get too self-conscious. At the other end of not knowing what you don't know is kind of glimpsing how big this room of all belly dance knowledge is, and not having a chance to rifle through it yet, and just getting like paralyzed by the like, oh god, I'm gonna offend somebody, or the belly dance police are gonna come and excommunicate me, which is where I was, thanks to Buzz, for quite a while.
If people don't remember what Buzz was, or you weren't around for that, it was a really huge belly dance forum which had tons mm-hmm. of useful information, but also a lot of like small group infighting, and a lot of us got a little burned out over there.
Yeah, I learned a lot from it, and in the long term it made me a better dancer, but in the short term I got really like terrified of the belly dance police, and I like internet stormed out of it because I asked a very genuine question trying to learn more about Umkal Zoom music, and it got answered with a lot of snobbery, and I was like, I'm done. So yeah, like that's another pitfall when you're on your own, is finding that balance between like, okay, I know I don't know this, so I'm gonna have some humility and I'm gonna keep searching for more information, and not letting yourself get so self-conscious that you just can't dance or can't enjoy it anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to tell if you're getting accurate information. Answering the actual question you just asked. I think most people probably saw the first Pirates of the Caribbean when Jeffrey Rush's character says, there are more guidelines than actual rules. And I think the way to tell if you're getting accurate information is how does it fit in with what you already know? And that can be tricky because you have to start from kind of an accurate knowledge base, which is another reason it's good to have a solid teacher when you're first starting out. There's only two real like rules in belly dance. If you're talking about rules that cover every style. And they are never, ever, ever lock out your knees. Your legs might be straight, and especially if you're doing modern styling, they're probably going to be straight, but they should never be locked out. And the other never, ever rule is don't flash the audience. And that goes out the window if you're doing burlesque fusion, but otherwise, don't flash the audience. Those are the only two like real rules in belly dance. And everything else depends on the context of what style and style you're doing and situation you're performing in. So you had Sahra on talking about how she kind of conceptualizes Egyptian folk dance as a puzzle, and to understand where a piece of that puzzle fits, you need to know which puzzle it belongs to. So if you're hearing somebody say that there's only like one true way, then there might be one true way if you are doing a character piece where you're portraying a specific dancer at a specific time period. But as soon as you grow that to any dancer from this style and era, then the kind of quote unquote right way is going to expand. And if you expand that even more into like anything that's belly dancey, then, you know, that whole right way thing gets really fuzzy. And that's obviously, there are certain things, like the relation to the music and the audience and certain elements that make it belly dance and not some other kind of dance. And those are very important. And if you want information about that, you should listen to Nadira's podcast where she has Alia Thabit on. I'm not reinventing the wheel. I'm going to tell people to go where the information already exists.
Thank you. And for the record, she's been on the show 3 times and I don't remember which one you're referring to, but all of them are available in our archives.
I'm referring to all of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you learn about kind of understand how the different styles of belly dance have been influenced and how, or at least that they interact with each other, and you try to understand those dance styles on their own terms. And I can go into a whole entire extra, like, 2-hour chat about the different styles. But the short version is that what goes depends on what context you're dancing in. I think you also kind of, when we were chatting beforehand, you also kind of mentioned the whole, like, the anything goes attitude and, like, getting the middle ground there. I've only heard, outside of fusion, I've only heard anything goes from one dancer in kind of the older AMCAB style. And in that context, it makes sense because where they were coming from in that, like, in that first generation of belly dancers in the US, a lot of them were coming from different performance disciplines. So you think of like Jamila Salimpour, who started with the circus. I think Burt Balladin came from vaudeville. Naima Akif was also a circus performer before she belly danced. So they're approaching this as entertainers rather than historians, and they're putting puzzle pieces from Egyptian, from Turkish, from Lebanese, from Greek, from Persian, North African. They're puzzle pieces from all different puzzles, and they're putting them together to make a whole new mosaic that created the vintage American style. So that's the only place outside of fusion where I've ever heard someone say, like, oh, anything goes. And that same dancer, like, 10 minutes later, after she was saying, like, saying that she doesn't like how these modern dancers are telling her that she's doing it wrong. It's all belly dance. It all goes. And then later she's like, but the Egyptian dancers are doing it wrong. So I don't know that anybody actually means it when they say anything goes.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when you and I were talking about this, it was more of the I'm an artist and you can't criticize my art.
Yeah.
Balancing that with the audience's expectations and the mm-hmm. cultural setting.
Yeah,
and I think one of the reasons... I think one of the reasons why the early AMCAB dancers were able to do that was because they were still being vetted by majority Middle Eastern yeah. audiences. You know, yeah, the folks who were saying, we like her, hire her again, were mm-hmm. what knew what the real thing was. And when they saw this mosaic, they still recognized things and yeah. liked what they got.
Exactly. Exactly. And like, it's not that, you know, like I said, they're taking puzzle pieces from the actual... from the actual countries of origin and fitting them together. So like, even if you're doing fusion, you have to have something kind of unified about what it is you're saying. So when I was in Fredonia, I was going there for theater, for production design. And we had it kind of ground into us that if you are going to put something on stage, it has to further the story. So you're not going to send Cruella de Vil on stage dressed like a hippie because the audience is going to get confused. So same thing, you're not going to dance Egyptian Oriental to Romani 9-8. So if you don't want to hear a Sparkle Bunny talk about having something of belly dance in tribal belly dance, then you can read the Gilded Serpent interview with Jill Parker. So.
Cool. And I don't think either of us have anything against fusion, right?
No, God, no.
Really good fusion is like...
When I first started, I was like, I want to dance like Rachel Bryce. That's all I care about.
There's some tremendous artistry going on in the fusion world.
No, absolutely.
Really great dancing. So none of us are knocking this. We're just talking context.
Thank you. Yes. Yes. It's awesome. Just it's just context. And I love all styles of belly dance. Some of them are more my taste than others, but I think talking about different styles should not be a judgment thing. Like, things can be different, but not less. Mm-hmm.
Super important, you guys, and that's something to watch out for from hearing from your teachers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that I think was a little bit of a detour, but I really liked where we went with that.
Sorry.
No, I think I did that. So, you know, coming back to this, you know, kind of pitfalls thing, you know, it really sounds like getting overwhelmed is one of the major problems. How do you acknowledge how big that room is without, you know, getting freaked out and wanting to huddle up in the corner?
Yeah. You make yourself a syllabus, you make yourself a map. I used to really overwhelm my students when I first started teaching because I tend to get really excited about things and want to tell everybody everything that I know. Which is why we ended up on that detour. So it took me a while to stop trying to cram everything I knew into the first like 8 or 10 weeks of class. And that was probably because I didn't trust myself to retain my students. What happened is I sat down and I mapped out like a full curriculum, how to get them from, so everybody, belly dance comes from the Middle East, and get them all the way to, oh, of course you know who one costume is. You do a lovely Lilith Hope, or whatever the Turkish version of that is. I wish I knew more about Turkish.
Aşkın Gecesi? Night of Love, maybe?
Okay. No, I just mean like a, whatever like a Turkish standard of, oh, of course you know. Of course you know what I'm talking about. Is what I meant by that.
Gotcha.
I've had Lilith Hulb described to me by musicians as a big girl song. So that's what I think. So once I made like a kind of a curriculum and said like, okay, this is advanced material, this is intermediate material, it let me kind of start rationing what I was telling them, which let me go further in depth with things and stopped overwhelming them and let them know I had a plan for a place that they could grow to. So that's why it's good to map it out, because you're not stuck with, oh God, I need to learn all of this right now. You know, I'm gonna just focus on the rhythms for now. And then I'll start learning about the different melody instruments and, you know, so on.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned level. You know, how do you choose appropriate material for your level? Right. For example, rhythms is a huge area. You know, what how do you tell as a student what degree of rhythm knowledge is appropriate for yourself as a beginner or as an intermediate student?
So you look at Mary Ellen Donald. She's got a couple CDs, Middle Eastern drum rhythms for beginner, volume 1 and 2, and for intermediate / advanced 1 and 2, which are the same rhythms, just faster, and like more decorated and everything. I'd say start off, like as far as rhythms go, start off with a base of, like Belody, aka Masmudi Sagir. And by the way, people, if you hear people telling you that Belody is not the name of that rhythm, that it's wrong, this is another one of those, like, it's right in certain context situations. it, what I have heard said to me is that in the U.S. and in like the Levantine area, it's called Beledi, but in Egypt, it's called Masmoudi Segir, which means the little Masmoudi. This is another one of those, there are more guidelines than actual rules. So Beledi, Masmoudi Kabir, Saidi, Shiftateli, Malfouf, Maksoum, Ayub, Filahi, Karshlama. Whether you're planning to do just Egyptian or not, learn Karshlama, like learn to recognize. This is a 9-8. I better not dance to it in 4-4 time. Wahda, Vals, and Vox. I would say those are the ones to kind of start your foundation with, and then build on things like Semai, Khaliji rhythms, Nawari, the different six time signature Debki rhythms, Rumba, Bolero, Zeffa. And by the time you're more advanced, you're going to be starting to focus on like things that are specific to your style. So I really can't answer that at an advanced level, because like something that, what rhythms you need to know if you want to really focus on Moroccan and North African is going to be very different than the rhythms you need to learn if you want to focus on Egyptian or if you want to focus on Turkish.
Cool. And, you know, how do you decide what areas to focus on or in what order?
So you want to start with a very general knowledge. It's kind of like when you are in, when you're in school and you're learning math, science, arts, chemistry is another science, literature, history, you learn all of that in all the way up through high school, and you don't start picking like an area to specialize in until you're in college. And you want to start with where do you want to be and work backwards from there. So it can be really easy to be like, okay, well, I'm a beginner, so I'm going to focus on these things that I know about right now. And then when I become an intermediate, then I'll add this and that and the other thing. And what ends up happening is, or what can end up happening, is you kind of end up needing to invent more advanced levels in order to fit all that in if you start kind of dividing things up from beginner forward. So instead, start from advanced and work backwards. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what are some of the components of a good dance education? As you're doing that, what are some of the topic areas or skills or concepts or information that you want to make sure mm-hmm. that you cover?
I have a list.
Lists!
Yay! So it's things like rhythm, musicality, set structure, audience, costuming, technique. All right, so Belly Dance Clubhouse is where you get the why and the how. For a second, we're going to talk about the which. Not the Halloween kind. Okay. So if you are an advanced dancer, so this is the dancer who has just gotten her master's degree in belly dance. You should know your must-know songs, plus some more like obscure classics that are like your favorites. They might not be must-know, but you really like them. Proficient with a variety of props, proficient with relevant folkloric styles. So, I mean, like if you're an advanced Turkish style dancer, then you don't really need to know Shikat. Which is a Moroccan folk dance. If you're an advanced dancer, body line and movement are under the dancer's control and used to convey what they want to convey. You can identify a song's context and mood, know what your songs are about, or you can find translations when you need to. You can control the pace and the mood of a performance to provide variation in energy and hold your audience for a full set. You can answer in a soundbite form, where does belly dance come from, and have a deeper understanding of the style that you're focusing on's history. And I kind of assume that by the time people are advanced dancers, they've picked one thing to focus on, because otherwise you're going to get overwhelmed. So if you do balancing props and you can combine them with floor work smoothly, and if you're doing something like, you can also do interesting non-balancing sections with any prop that you balance. So if you do sword and you just plop it on your head and dance, that might be really great. But if you really want to consider yourself an advanced dancer with sword, then you should be able to do, you know, things before you put it on your head to build suspense, things like that. And I think the mark of an advanced dancer, you should be able to improvise a whole set in a way that you can interact with the audience, you can transfix them, or you can play with them. That's really at the advanced level. And you might be advanced in one skill and not necessarily in another, and that's totally normal and fine. Okay, right in the next level. By the time you kind of finish your intermediate studies, when you get your belly dance bachelor's degree, familiar with veil, balancing props like sword, tray jug, belly progressions, if you're doing Egyptian, Saidi or Debki style cane, floor work, drum solo, and familiar with taking tips. You can decide how you feel it's appropriate to take tips, which is another situation.
That could be a whole episode too.
By the time you get your belly dance master's degree, have a good foundation of your must-know songs, and you could put together a whole set with just songs that you're already familiar with. You're able to map out a song, know your important rhythms, and as well as some folkloric ones, and you're starting to add more advanced rhythms. Be aware of energy use and focus, even if you're not really proficient with it yet. Be able to use your body line, floor pattern, and expression all at the same time. Within the context of a choreography, at least be able to look really polished. You should definitely be able to improvise a whole set with like reasonable level of confidence by the time you get your belly dance bachelor's degree. Able to use movement choice, size, texture, and intensity to capture the music, beginning to polish arm and leg lines, beginning to interact with the audience and incorporate awareness. Know what styles you would like to pursue. Know which folk dances apply to that style. And know who are the high-level dancers that you'd be interested in learning from, whether or not they're local. Okay, ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so by the end of beginner, so this is by the time you get your belly dance high school diploma. And I'm saying it this way because it's a spectrum. You're always kind of building along on these. By the time you get your belly dance high school diploma, you're able to identify your melody instruments and percussion instruments. You can execute technique with good posture and arms and little thought, so no concentration face or freezing up. You might still have to concentrate a little bit, but it shouldn't be like super obvious. And you should be able to keep dancing without totally blanking. You can transition between movements and at a time that is appropriate in the music. So you should be aware of the music's phrasing by then. Aware of the preparation moves and of kind of intersecting shapes. So you might still, your transitions might still be a little clunky, but you kind of know, okay, well, it's because I need to prepare for this move before I start it, or, well, you know, this 8 would go into a circle better if I changed it over here where they connect to each other. You can play Simon Says Shapes without freezing. So this is a game that I play with my students for movement recall. You and I have a really similar way of teaching improvisation as far as movement recall goes, because I started with that Dancing the Sacred Shapes by the Goddess Dancing DVD. Right from the beginning, I already had all the movements kind of categorized in my head by different shapes. So I put on music and I tell my dancers, Simon says circle, and they can do any circle they want. Oop, sorry. Or Simon says lines, and they can do hip drops, hip slides, chest slides, anything like that. So by the time you get your belly dance high school diploma, you should be able to make it through a game of Simon Says Shapes without freezing up. And be able to muddle through a song improvising without freezing up. Even if you don't feel like you really like your performance, you should be able to get through a full improvisation without totally freezing up. By the time you're graduating from beginner to intermediate, you should be able to identify a rhythm and speak or play or clap out the skeleton. Not necessarily all three of those. Everybody learns rhythms differently, so have some kind of handle on how you understand the rhythms. You can hear the music's phrases and textures and rises and falls. You know about a wide range of Middle Eastern folk dances. So that does not mean you have to be able to do them. You just have to be able to know, oh yeah, Kalia, that's Iraqi. Rome, that's Turkish. Know where props came from. Know who are the major musicians and a few of their like most important songs, and able to identify different styles like within reason. If somebody's like kind of on the cusp between different styles, then you know that's kind of a trick question for you at that level. And know about the relationships between those different styles, and have some idea of where did belly dance come from, even if it's just a little bit of like, well, here are some of the origin myths, and these are the things we know and these are what we don't. And know what are the parts of a belly dance set, both for AMCAB and Egyptian and or Turkish. So that's a lot to learn while you're a beginner before you can call yourself an intermediate dancer.
Well, I think that's why I like the way that you use like the degree framework, mm-hmm. is that, you know, high school takes 4 years.
Exactly.
Right? So, you know, some teachers' beginner class is 8 weeks long. Mine is a year long. Other people, it might take 2 years to graduate out of their level mm-hmm. one, right?
Well, that's not level one. That's level two. I haven't gotten to level one yet.
So you have another level. Okay, gotcha.
I have an introductory level. Mm-hmm. So in a beginner class, the way I have it broken up is a beginner class, you could have somebody who's been dancing 2 years alongside somebody dancing 1 year, alongside someone dancing 4 years. Introductory level is, this is your first 2 months of belly dance. The way I have it laid out, the way I have my classes set up, is the first like 2 months is in the introductory class. This is your hip bones connected to the leg bone class. And that's where you learn basic posture. You learn your basic movement vocabulary. You should be able to find the one in a rhythm, find the beat in a rhythm, and know the difference between a beat and a rhythm. Be aware of your body, including your arms and your feet. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have control of them yet. It just means that, like, yes, I have hands and they do things, and my feet touch the floor. And believe me, that was something I had to learn. I did not walk into my beginner class knowing that when I was starting. You should be introduced to improvisation within a structure, and be starting to get the technique and like have some control of like what is your psoas doing, and starting to be able to avoid kind of that sway back situation. And know just what regions contributed to belly dance. What are some common origin myths, and who are the Awalim? That's introductory. That's level one. And that's the way I divide it. Every teacher divides it differently. I'm not saying that this is the be all end all, but if you're trying to map things out, then it's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, you know, throughout all of this, I've been talking a lot about the role of the teacher. So, mm-hmm. how do you get feedback when you're taking a more self-guided journey, whether you don't have a teacher or you're working on stuff that your teacher isn't covering in class?
So the first thing is film yourself. I can like practically hear people on the other end of the call going, I don't want to film myself. And I hate it too. But it helps you see things that you can't see in the mirror. There's a lot of people who will do remote video critiques. There's Skype lessons and things like that. This is another question that I kind of want to answer with the which. There's three things that you really need outside an outside eye on. And the first is that your technique is like ergonomically sound, that you're not going to break yourself. I'm not going to name names, but there are some dancers where I watch a particular type of folkloric belly dance fusion that they do, and I'm just really hoping that they don't snap their spines. And it's really distracting and scary to watch. You should get an outside eye to make sure that your technique is, that you're not developing bad habits, and that that you're not going to injure yourself. The other thing you need to get an outside opinion on is that you don't undercut. So there's Samira Sharuk's website rates by, or page on her website rates by region, which is really helpful for this. But it's also something you want to reach out to the local professionals for. If you're ready to start performing and taking money for your performances, Morocco has a really good article about why you shouldn't undercut. But it can be another one of those little pitfalls of you don't know what you don't know. Where I started for a restaurant show, we did three shows. We did three sets for the going rate. And then when I moved to New York, I didn't even think that to ask how many shows do you include for the going rate. And the New York dancers didn't even think that they would have to specify, because of course it's just one show for the going rate. So I was dangerously close to undercutting on accident. And then I found out and I fixed my sets, and they put the wording a little more specific so that it wouldn't happen again. But that's another thing. You have to kind of reach out and find out what is exactly the deal in this area. So the other thing that you need to get an outside opinion on is your performance level. So how is to, like I said, to find a Skype lesson, to get a video critique or something like that. If I can answer the why of that.
Please.
I'm going to put the fear into you, and then I'm going to try and take it back out. Not you, but to listeners.
Understood.
Thank you. So if you're performing outside of a student show, okay, if you're in a student situation, people know they're seeing students and it is understood, you're good. You can be as good or as bad as you want to be in a student show. Hopefully with respect to your fellow students. But if you're dancing in it for the general public in a situation where they don't know that you're a student, you might be the only belly dancer that they ever see. And when you're an adult, they don't have any frame of reference. They don't know if you just started 2 weeks ago or if you started 20 years ago. So whatever your impression of them, or whatever their impression of you, you want to make sure you give them a good impression of the dance. So just like when you're performing outside, you want to keep in mind that you might be the only belly dancer anybody ever sees. And I put too much pressure on myself with that exact thing, so I'm going to try and take some of that pressure off. You get a video critique of yourself, and you get a teacher kind of giving you that stamp saying, like, yes, you are ready to perform, so that you can go on stage without that self-doubt. This, I'm not saying you need to get a critique to tear you down or stop you from performing. I'm trying to say you need to get a critique so that you're not up there thinking, like, is this good enough when you're actually performing? Because there's always going to be somebody in the audience who, no matter how classy you are, no matter how well you are presenting this dance, and no matter how good an ambassador for this dance you're being, there's going to be somebody in the audience who only sees it through whatever kind of filter their expectations are giving them, and you can't control that. And you shouldn't be expected to. So you want to be able to go up on stage with, I know that I'm presenting this dance well, and if you're bringing something else to my performance, that's on you. There's a Dave Grohl quote: you can sing a song to 85,000 people and they'll sing it back to you for 85,000 different reasons. One thing that helped me get over that whole, oh my God, I hope I'm doing this right, I hope they get the right idea, is is a Ruth St. Denis quote that I'm going to try and get through without choking up. I have performed for thousands when they found me exotic, the vogue, daring, but I have danced at any given time for about 10 people. They're the ones that left the theater forever different from the way they were when they came in. All of my long life, I've danced for those 10. And for me, I dance for those women and girls in the audience who need to see, and for the guys in the audience who need to see something strong that's not destructive. Because I feel like all of our cultural kind of depictions of strength are like superheroes blowing things up. So it's nice to see somebody just like rock a floor work section or something that's like really strong, but still like vulnerable and soft and creative instead of destructive. So get your critique, get a teacher that you trust to tell you, yes, you're definitely ready to present this dance to the general public, and then dance for those 10 people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, we've talked about a couple of the different ways that we can work with teachers. Besides mm-hmm. weekly teachers, what other kinds of mentorship relationships are out there?
You already answered this. You had a clubhouse call with Sahina about mentors.
I know, but our listeners might not have listened to that one.
Well, I'm telling them to go into the archives and get it. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. Yeah, it doesn't have to be your weekly teacher to get feedback or to get mentoring along your journey. It does have to be somebody who has read ahead from you. We're thinking about like a class where there's a syllabus and there's always that one student that's reading ahead. I wish I had time and was a fast enough reader to be that student. but yeah, you want it to be somebody who there's some kind of mutual support going on, so that they're getting something out of it too, but also so that you're not feeling like, oh, am I nagging them about this? And you know, you're a little freer to ask them what you need to ask them if you know they're getting something out of it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mentor lives in another city, and mm-hmm. I literally talked to her yesterday to help her with a technical problem.
Oh, nice.
So there's definitely, you know, give and take makes a big difference. and, you know, you can always pay them.
Yes, you can definitely always pay them.
Especially if it's something that obviously fits into like a lesson context, whether you're dancing or not.
Exactly.
Like, hey, I'm curious about this thing. Can you tell me about this? Or, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
But as long as there's some give and take, I think you're good.
Exactly, yeah.
Cool. And, you know, even that, if I can throw my own experience in here, when mm-hmm. I was a baby performer, so maybe I'd been dancing for like 3 years and I was just starting to dip my toes in that, there was a dancer here in Boston who kind of took me under her wing, and she would do things like taking me music shopping, right? We had, and I'm not kidding you, it was a TV repair shop a couple towns over that had an entire wall full of Middle Eastern music. Because it was from my Armenian family, and that's what they liked. And so they also sold things. And I learned later mm-hmm. that, you know, dancers in, like, California would mail order music from this place. But we had
amazing.
In town. And so this lady, she would just, like, take me music shopping. And she would, like, we'd walk through the aisle together. And she would say, mm-hmm. well, what have you been listening to? Oh, well, given that, maybe you should listen to this, this, and this. And then I would buy her lunch afterwards.
I almost forgot to say this.
Yeah. So, you know, she gave me all of her, she gave me a lot of time. But I also tried to do things for her, like, you know, when she would take me out music shopping, I would buy her lunch.
Oh my god, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I almost forgot to tell people about getting music. When you're on your own and you don't have a teacher telling you like, oh, this is what we're going to perform to, or just when you're trying to develop your own style, I always tell my beginner students to get compilation CDs, like the Masters of Belly Dance or like some of the Belly Dance Superstars volumes, because it gives you a chance to figure out what are your tastes when you have a compilation CD, and it gets you exposed to stuff that you might not have listened to otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell everybody this, the sooner you do this in your dance journey, the better. Start making playlists with your music. Sort your music, because you're going to hate having to do it when you've got 2,000 songs on your computer.
I did that with 8,000 a couple years ago, and it took me 9 months.
I would do a couple minutes
every day, and you just listen to Farah here, folks. Yeah, take her seriously.
I had less than 2,000 when I did it, and luckily I was on winter break during my first master's degree. And it took me a couple months of like putting in a couple hours at a time to get things sorted. So like sort things into what style is it? Is it an entrance piece? Is it a veil piece? Is it Egyptian? Is it Lebanese? Is it, you know, sort them into anything that you can think of you might have to sort through to make a set. You're thinking like, I might need to make a set for a Lebanese wedding, then have a Lebanese playlist. If you are going to dance at a Greek restaurant, have a Greek music playlist. If you, you know, have a fast and a slow playlist, and songs might end up on multiple playlists, which is good. And it just helps you find things, sort your music and get compilation CDs so that you can figure out what is your taste. Mm-hmm.
And if I can piggyback on that, mm-hmm. Your tastes are going to grow and evolve as you listen more. Yes. So don't get rid of the things that you don't like now. Keep them in your library and listen to them again sometime later.
Very, very, very much.
We all hate the Mizmar.
Especially Mizmar.
First time, but we all love it a couple of years in.
Thanks. Well, I wanted to throw in one other thing. The Armenian, this is a little bit of a tangent, the Armenian music store. Between when I had stopped dancing after my high school friends kept her DVD and we kind of like fell off the radar. And when I started again in undergrad, I was with my parents. I was still in high school, I think. And we went to my dad's music teacher's house for dinner. And his wife was Armenian and her sister was visiting from Armenia. So my dad's music teacher's sister-in-law was over. And after dinner, she wanted to do Dance Arabia, and that was where I got my first belly dance music. And I didn't find out until like 9 later that it was a Shireen song. I was in a workshop, and the teacher was talking to somebody else about something completely unrelated, and her computer was just playing whatever was next on the playlist. And I was like, stop everything! What is this song? I need to know!
Cool. All right. You know, so we talked a little bit of a while ago about how, you know, we can't be all things to all people. And so how do you determine whether to specialize, how tightly to specialize, or even when to start that process?
Start with a general education. Like I said, you know, when you're in high school, you take science, math, arts, history, literature. You don't pick a focus until you're in college or your master's level. And picking a focus, I think, helps you avoid getting overwhelmed. So like I can look at like all the workshops that are going on now that I live in Manhattan. There's a lot that I can actually reach physically, not financially. And I can look at them and I know to save my time and money for the things that I'm interested in. But I know that because I've already tried a bunch of things. So when I first started, I thought I only want to do tribal style. I want to dance like Rachel Bryce. I don't want to put on sparkly things. That's silly. And then the only dance class that was around was at the time, I only thought there were two styles. So I used the C word, cabaret. And I went, I was like, oh, I kind of like this. And I kept doing it. And almost 12 years later, now I'm vintage Egyptian all the way down to my bones, down to my psoas. It's kind of like dessert. So I tell people that I've never had Reese's cups before and they're like, oh my God, your life has been so deprived and sad. I was like, no, my life's been void of anaphylactic shock. I'm allergic to peanut butter. But if you have, you don't have to go your whole life depriving yourself of Turkish style. Or of Raita style. You try the desserts. And if you, nobody's allergic to Raita style. If you don't like it, you don't have to keep eating it, but at least you tried it. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And I want to reinforce something that is
for not ever having peanut butter and chocolate.
If you're allergic, what are you going
to
do?
When I listen to
almond butter cups, Newman's Own makes almond butter cups. I don't know if they're any good. Oh, that's big.
I'm also allergic to almonds.
Okay, never mind.
I was 27 before I had baklava because I had to find a place that made cheese baklava.
I am mildly allergic to walnuts, so yeah. I understand baklava pain.
If you're ever in Syracuse, I'll take you to Biblos where they make cheese baklava.
It sounds like künefe. It's a Turkish dessert, sort of like that.
Ooh, it's delicious. The owner's daughter is also allergic to nuts. So
nice. Anyway, I want to touch on kind of a personal note on some of what you just said is that for me, being a beginner at something is really comfortable. I know a lot of people are kind of afraid to go into their first class and not know what they're doing. But there's a class of people, myself included, who are totally comfortable not knowing something. But once we get kind of competent, we feel like we need to know everything.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And so,
I used to be a freaking improv star in class. Like, I can still improv on stage. But like in class, when my teacher like tells us to do something, I just start doubting myself. Like, well, how does she want me to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No. I love that you did that because I actually forgot what I was going to say for a second and you just gave me an out.
Okay.
For me, when I got to a certain point where I was actually like out there performing and getting paid when I performed and, really presenting myself as a professional, I kind of felt like I had to be really, 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 really good at all of the styles. Mm-hmm. And, my focus at that point was very heavily MCAB with a Turkish bent.
Yep.
Right. And so, I did some cross training in Arabic, I did a lot of work on that as well, but I kind of felt like unless I was absolutely awesome at all of these styles, I was doing something wrong by calling myself a professional.
No.
Right. And so it wasn't until you can't be all things to all people. Well, I'm a big believer in exploring lots of things. Right.
Mm-hmm. No, me too. One of the things, if you explore a lot of things, you start to make connections that other people might not have noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding how the Ottoman Empire influenced Egyptian dance, for example. If you only ever explore one or the other, you're not going to be able to figure that out.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so, when I was kind of getting back into performing after a couple of years down with injuries, it felt like this huge wall I had to climb up because, oh God, I have to get my endurance back and I have to, get back into this and I have to get back into this and I have to review all of this stuff. And what I really needed to do and what really got me back on track was to focus on my primary thing. And so I essentially gave myself, for two or three years, my mantra to myself is you are not responsible for anything Arabic.
Yeah.
And I had to actively avoid it for a while because every time I encountered it, I would feel bad that I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I kind of got over that, and especially as I kind of got back into the swing of things with my primary styles, it started to feel more and more like something that I wanted to do because I just really liked the music, right? Not any kind of like, this is a job requirement that I'm failing at, but I want to work on this again just because I love this one song. Let's spend some time on this.
When you specialize, you get to have a niche. So, especially as a professional, when people want to hire somebody, you might not get every single gig. I mean, if you're the only dancer in your area, then you will. You might not be the right fit for every single gig, but those gigs that you are the right for, you get to charge a premium because you're the best at that.
Mm-hmm. And, also just kind of cutting yourself some slack. In some areas.
Yes, oh my God, so much.
It frees you up to approach what you're doing with joy and with love, and you're a better dancer when you do that.
Yeah, can I be honest with you?
Go for it.
I'm not super into Rata style. I really, really love focusing on vintage Egyptian, and I have dabbled in Rata style, and I have so much, immense respect for it. But it's not something that I feel compelled to invest a lot of time and money in, especially because I have very, very dyslexic feet. The rest of me can be fine. My feet are going to be off in another room doing something else. So, I know if there's a workshop on on the styles that I want to do, then it's worth investing that time and money. But if not, then, you know, like I definitely still take workshops outside of my home styles. I did a North African dance intensive last year. If I had the money for it, I was going to do the Turkish style workshop with Ozgun that's coming up soon. I'm going to at least go see the show. But, you know, yeah, you can't do everything unless you're Dorian Gray. Live forever, then you can figure it out.
Cool. All right. Well, you know, so far we've been talking about this from the perspective of the student, but I know that a lot of the folks who listen to this are teachers themselves. So what can teachers do or change about how they conduct their classes to support your students in taking a more active role in their education?
I don't know what they need to change because I don't know what they're doing to begin with. But I do teach in concepts instead of just feeding people choreographies. So don't let them get away with tour bus. And I still teach choreographies, but I kind of make my students work for it a little more depending on what level they're at. So before we start any choreography, except for the one that's like the review at the end of a beginner session, that's like a choreography just to the finale of a song to review the movements we've learned so far. Before I start any choreography past that, everybody gets out something to write with and a piece of paper, and we map out the song. And I explain, like, well, the rhythm changed here, so, you know, we're gonna do this. Or this is the book instrument, so we want a movement that, yada, yada. The more advanced they are, the more it's up to them to kind of answer those questions. So I even with my beginner, not introductory, but beginner students, when we're doing choreographies, we're like, so what instrument is this? And just wait for their blank face to go away and for them to remember that it's the nai or whatever it is. A lot of times they remember, they just don't remember the name. But also, I think the biggest takeaway for teachers is to make a plan for your class and have a build. And I know it's really hard if you have kind of a drop-in format, but it is also good for the retention of your students. And having spent so many years where my only option was workshops, I get so frustrated when I go into a class and it's just, well, we're going to work on whatever the teacher feels like working on today. Because you need to have time in class to build your skills and to see progress. And like, that's the big advantage that you have with regular classes over workshops, is being able to build that and to follow up on things. So if you're in class and you're like, well, we did Bale last week, so I'm sure you went home and worked on it. Are you sure? So we're going to do drum solos today. No matter how much your students do or don't work on things at home, they're still going to need follow-up on it. And it's really discouraging to be constantly given material and then just sit adrift with it.
Mm-hmm. And are there any ways that you can recommend for letting your students know that they can take that role or letting them know how to go about doing it? I think especially a lot of students who come from Western dance backgrounds are very used to the tour bus is the only game in town.
Yeah.
Because that's the norm.
Give them homework. Give them kind of open-ended homework. Like, hey, I want you to work on one Farida Latrush song each week this month. This year. So it's going to take a while. I was trying to pick somebody who wrote fewer songs than, or who put out fewer songs than Oom Kalsoom, and I did not do a good enough job. But yeah, like give them kind of open-ended homework. Like I want you to map out this song and come up with a skeleton choreography that we'll work on in class. And it depends on what level they're at, what is going to be appropriate homework for them. I send my students emails every week with just information in them and lots of YouTube clips for them to watch. Lots of YouTube clips for them to watch and links to like sheer.net and Shem's Dance. Oh my God, if you are looking to get yourself an orientation into the stuff you need to know for belly dancing, go to shemsdance.com and look at her resources. She's amazing. She's a dancer in the Baltimore area. She was on, I think the first season of Project Belly Dance. And she was one of the speakers at the very first like real workshop that I ever took. And yeah, her website's Why I Understand the Difference Between Different Styles. And she has stuff on there about the parts of a set and different types of music. And it's wonderful. I'm going to stop gushing now. I'm going to stop fangirling.
We'll link to it.
Okay. Thank you. She has no idea that I'm talking about this, by the way. But I don't feel like I need to ask permission to plug people, do I? Do I have to ask permission?
No. If something's available publicly, just post it.
Okay. Yeah, it is available publicly, and she's a great resource. So, did I answer that, or did I get off on too much of a tangent?
Oh, you totally answered that. I wanted to make sure we were done, though.
Thank you.
All right. And then, you know, kind of the last consideration that we've got here is that, you know, when we think about people in this teacher role, often that's when we as dancers lose our own teachers. So my teacher kind of retired very quietly. And so a lot of us find ourselves, you know, in the teacher role, but still knowing that there's a lot more to learn because, of course, there always is. So are there any special considerations in this progress for people who are very experienced and possibly teaching who need to guide their own ongoing education?
I mean, at that point, you're just looking for dancers who are more advanced than you. It's pretty similar. The big difference is that you have background information and context that you're able to compare new information to. So if anything, you're in a better place to be doing this as a more experienced dancer. You know, kind of that information that you already have boosts you up and lets you see farther. Like if you can think of it like a being off in a dark room and, but in this case, you're on a valley floor when you first start, and the more you know, the more you can see over that ridge of the valley and see how big is this mountain range I'm in. And, as a really experienced dancer, you can kind of look out and you can tell whether it's that the beacons of Gondor are lit and they call for aid, or if it's just the sun reflecting off a glacier.
Nice. So,
thank you. The other, I had another Lord of the Rings metaphor in here.
Go for it. I want to hear it.
Okay. So, this is actually a triple nerd whammy. The you don't know what you don't know paradox is you're in a dark room. You have a little candle in front of you. You don't know how big the room is. And sometimes it's like being in the mines of Moria. And you think you're in just like a tiny little cave, and the wizard guy lights up the room and it's like this huge city square. But I also usually, when I picture that room of all belly dance knowledge, it's a mixture between like a room at a museum and that room in Harry Potter where they keep the prophecies. It's really hard to tell how big that room is.
Nice. Awesome.
My gift card should be laminated.
Oh, yeah. If it's not laminated, it doesn't count. Nice. And so, you
it's
know,
laminated, if I picture, how do you get it stamped?
You get it stamped before you get it laminated.
Okay.
And so, you know, thinking about, you know, how this is different for, you know, teachers and experienced dancers, I'd actually like to share two things that I kind of learned the hard way. One is that, you know, you mentioned looking to people more advanced than you. And one of the big cautions I would have to people is that that doesn't mean that they're more advanced than you in every way. The more experienced I get, the more things I start learning and stealing from people whose carbon copies I really don't want to be. you know, people who don't talk to me and whose style doesn't talk to me, or who, I don't want to get judgy, so it's not like, oh my God, they're a terrible dancer, but you know, people who I don't feel like I would choose to be my primary teacher, but they're really good at a couple things, or they hold their hands in a way. And I just think that's like, whatever skill that is just something that I want to steal from them.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the more experienced I get, the less I feel like apprenticing myself to somebody to gain the whole of their knowledge. And the more I start focusing on absorbing smaller things. So one of the examples I talk about in my class a lot is that, you know, I had a whole bunch of injuries kind of midway through my career. And every time I would come out of PT, I would start with a beginner class with somebody that I hadn't studied with regularly. Specifically because I was afraid to do anything too vigorous because I wasn't sure what my body could handle. And so it was mostly like, I was treating it almost like an exercise class, right? Can I just like get back into the swing of dancing? And I picked up so many details from these teachers whose, you know, intermediate or advanced classes I had kind of cross-trained in a few years before that. But just taking their beginner class, I was able to absorb a lot of the details about how they were doing what they were doing instead of focusing on what they were teaching necessarily. And it was huge. I picked up some of my best stuff, you know, just by watching, you know, when does she flip her hands from up to down and small things like that. So, you know, I think that when we get more experienced, we feel like we need to reach for bigger and better, and sometimes smaller and more subtle really pays off.
Yeah. I went after my like long-term teacher stopped taking or stopped teaching intermediate classes, I went and took a few of her beginner classes, and it was partly because I wanted to learn how to teach beginners. But there was definitely things that I picked up there. I needed to learn how to teach beginners so that I didn't sound like a DVD, because my only beginner classes had been on a DVD.
And you know, that's advice.
That's actually another.
What?
That's actually another resource that you can use. You might have a teacher in your area where you really want to focus on learning how to be a dancer, and they only teach exercise classes. That's probably just a marketing decision on their point. They probably have the information to be able to teach you how to be a dancer. I forgot to mention that earlier.
I think that's a situation where supplementing with private lessons can go really well.
Right? Exactly,
like maybe you take their fitness class every week and you do a private with them every other week or once a month to kind of move that in a more performance direction. That can work really well and be really cost effective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't have to, if you don't have the cash for it, you don't have to take private lessons every week, because you can, if you are able to practice at home and do the homework they give you, then you can kind of stretch your dollar that way.
Cool. Can you believe we've been at this for 98 minutes?
Barely.
It feels like 20. Well, I think we better cut off the interview here, but we're going to move on to questions and answers. But before we do that, you know, if people take one thing away from this call, what would you want that to be?
It's going to be one thing, but it's going to go in two different ways. One is that it's okay to make mistakes if you learn from them and if you fix them. The other is that if you're an experienced dancer and you come across someone who's making mistakes, don't jump to thinking that she's out to undermine or drag down belly dance. She might just not know that she doesn't know. Or he might not know that he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Well, I am releasing a 2-DVD set. It's called Belly Dance, The Next Steps. The first volume is going to cover kind of how to practice, how to drill, how to get things into your muscle memory. Aslahan does a little a cameo on there. I teach the Egyptian style posture, and she teaches the Turkish style posture to kind of drive home what we were talking about. How, you know, you might hear things done differently by different teachers. Doesn't mean that one of them's wrong. Just means that they're different styles. And it also goes into how to learn about rhythms and the difference between the beat and the rhythm, and a bunch of stuff like that. One of the dancers that I used to dance with up in Syracuse drums for us on it. And then in the second volume, which I'm hoping to have out around Thanksgiving time so that people can get it for Christmas if they want, we're going to talk about how to how to improvise, how to kind of understand the musicality, and how to do transitions. And in all of them, because my goal was to make a thing that's, how do you get from hip bones connected to the leg bone to being an intermediate dancer? So that's a lot of material to cover, even in two DVDs. So what I do is, excuse me, in each of the DVDs, in each of those sections, I talk about the things that are usually kind of left off of those intermediate DVDs that a lot of teachers assume that you learned either in your high school music class or in your beginner belly dance class. So I talk about all of that and give you some exercises to start learning on it. And then I give people, then I plug a lot of other people's DVDs. Tell them this is where you can go for more information. So for example, in the improv section on the second DVD, we talk about movement vocab. We do the Simon Says categories exercise that I do with my students. And then I tell them to go buy your improv toolkit.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome. So these are my syllabus for getting from beginner to intermediate.
Mm-hmm. And how can people get that?
Well, I am getting real close to finishing editing the first volume. So what I would say is you can email me and pre-order it. It should be out in the next couple of weeks. Or you can go on my website, Farha Belly Dance, /shop, which is one of the top menu options, and it should be the top thing there. Right now, it's just a button to email me to pre-order, but I'll have it up there once I have the full copies that I can send.
Awesome. And if folks are listening to this later, today is yes. August 24th of 2017, so we're talking about a couple weeks from today. Just yes. Take that into account. It's probably already out.
I forgot about that. Thank you. Yeah, I'm almost done editing it and just have to send it to some folks to kind of proof watch it and make sure we get all the glitches out before I publish it.
Awesome. All right. So let's go ahead and open this up to questions. So if you are listening on the webcast specifically, and you're not using the computer audio or Skype or your phone, you'll find a little question bubble off to the right. So on the right-hand side, it looks like a little square cartoon question bubble with three dots. You can use that to open that up and you can type in a message. Or if you're listening by phone or Skype, you can press ** on your phone or Skype keypad to unmute yourself. And we would love to hear from you. So if you have questions or a comment, or if you want to share your favorite takeaway, jump right in. And there is always a delay while everybody decides if they want to be the first one.
I won't bite.
I like to say it's the good version of the cockroach syndrome, right? Like they say, if you see one cockroach, there are 100, right? If you have a question, chances are 10 people who are listening do too. So yes. You're doing everybody a favor if you ask it.
Yeah, that's always something I tell my students before they go take a workshop or when they're in class and I'm trying to get people to ask me questions. So I'm like, I can see y'all have questions on your faces.
Ooh, I like that wording too. All right, nobody. Maybe we did such a good job of, maybe I did such a good job of asking the question.
Yes, you did.
All right, well, I think we're going to call it here then. But if anybody changes their mind, remember, we do have a private Facebook group just for the Clubhouse members. I'll send out a link to that along with the call recording. And so you can ask questions there as well if you think of it. So thank you again so much, Farha.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was so much fun.
I know it was.
And thank you again to the Belly Dance Bundle. So if you'd like to check out this really heavily discounted bundle of fabulous online belly dance products from dancers, including me and several Clubhouse guests, you can find more information and get on the waiting list at bellydancegeek.com/bundle. And to let you know what's going on in the Belly Dance Geek world, I've actually launched a second podcast. We just named it recently. It's called More Than Steps.
And in this podcast, we talk about the same why and how stuff that we talk about here on the Clubhouse, but instead of me interviewing other people, these are my own thoughts that I'm actually sharing while I walk to the coffee shop in the morning. Besides being just me by myself, they're also a lot shorter than the Clubhouse podcasts. So if you don't have an hour or 90 minutes or sometimes longer than 90 minutes to sit down and listen, you can kind of take these in nice short and sweet bites. If you get the Clubhouse call invitations by email, then you'll also get a monthly digest of these. But if you don't want to wait, you can get those at bellydancegeek.com/steps. And it's also on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher under the title More Than Steps. All right. Well, this is the end of our call, but it doesn't mean that we have to be done with the conversation. Again, I'll be sending out a link to the private Facebook group where we can keep talking about this. And I'll also include a link to the call recording because we mentioned so much good stuff in this one. I'm sure you're going to want to listen to that again. But we'll also include links to some of the resources that were mentioned so that you can link directly to those. We also have a survey where you can give me some of your feedback. So if you have ideas for topics or speakers or other improvements that I can make to the Clubhouse, I would love to hear from you. And our next call is still TBD. I have a great guest in mind, but we haven't finalized whether she's going to be able to come on for September or not. So we'll keep that posted. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of Clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to join us, you can invite them to do that at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.